You're listening to the Lessons in Real Estate Show, sponsored by Mission First Capital, bringing real estate investment deals for active duty and veteran investors. Your host, Anthony Pinto, searched land, air, and sea to find military investors just like you investing in multifamily and commercial real estate, both active duty and veterans. Hear their stories, learn their lessons, and be inspired by the obstacles they have overcome on their path to financial freedom. Whether you are overseas or stationed at home, if you want to get started as a military real estate investor, this is the show for you. And now your host, Anthony Pinto.
I'm so excited to have you guys here today on the revamped, new and improved version of the Lessons in Real Estate Show. I wanted to refocus on my mission here in life with this podcast, and that is to help teach and inspire 1 million military members and veterans to achieve financial freedom through real estate. And as a part of the March to a Million campaign, my call is to show you the path to freedom of time and money, whether you intend to stay in for 20 years or get out next year. And so listen to the stories of fellow military members and investors just like you, struggling, overcoming, and achieving success in multifamily real estate, and even some of them doing it while active duty, and really dig into their lessons learned, as well as their failures on their path to success. But you came here for the show, so let's get to it. Hey, learners, and welcome back to another episode of the Lessons in Real Estate Show. I'm your host, Anthony Pinto. And again, today we have an amazing guest, an active duty Marine Corps officer who is using proprietary code to analyze investment opportunities and mitigate risk. He's also the owner of LTG Investments, with the purpose behind his business is to use real estate investing to fight human trafficking. And not only that, but he's investing from a distance by building a team. Today we have on Tyler Goebbels. Tyler, welcome to the show.
Hey, Anthony. Nice to meet you, brother. And thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice to meet you as well. And you know, we were just chatting beforehand that you totally look familiar, and we probably ran into the same people before. But it's just one of those things where you kind of run with it among the same group of people, but never actually interact with each other, because it's just a small world within the Navy and the Marine Corps.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. You look familiar, and I'm sure we've probably bumped into each other before, so not too much of a surprise, but yeah.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. So it looks like you've made, quite a name for yourself, not only being active duty and doing real estate, but, what you're doing and what your cause is with stopping human trafficking. So you have a very unique purpose, it seems, and a unique kind of end state. So I'm curious to kind of get through and talk how you got into that in the first place. But, let's start with your military background and how that led you into real estate.
Yeah. So I went to the Naval Academy. I'm from Plymouth, Michigan, originally. Went to the Naval Academy, told myself, I'm just going to serve my 5 years, just get on a boat, do 5 years, and just kind of hang out. That's what my mindset was when I first got there. Very quickly realized I did not want to be on a boat any longer than I had to be. I know you're a submariner, so maybe we're a little bit different in that regard. But, man, I spent 2 weeks on a boat after my freshman year and went, oh, no, I can't do this. And so the agreement I had made with my mom was that if I went to the Naval Academy, I wouldn't go into the Marine Corps. And I definitely wouldn't go into the infantry. And so when I graduated from Navy, I went into the Marine Corps and I went into the infantry. And so, sorry, Mom, I kind of screwed that one up. But that was kind of what my military career has been like at this point. I've been in for a little over 5 years, four of which have been as a infantry officer. And I'm on a current set of orders out to the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, getting my master's degree in operations research, which is basically data science, like machine learning, AI, and like heavy statistics and math centered degree, and computer code, stuff like that. I'm sure we'll talk about that kind of stuff later. Yeah. But as far as getting into real estate, man, it was always something that I really enjoyed looking at and doing. Even at the Naval Academy, I would have like spreadsheets built out. I was like, man, if I built this, like, and had no idea what I was doing as well. I was just like, man, I bet you could make $100 a month if you owned a house. Like, if you owned 100 houses, what would that look like? And so I could go back into my hard drive and see random spreadsheets I had made that are just like 100% wrong. But that was like kind of an interest level for me, right? Is I understood that real estate was something that you could scale, something that would be beneficial for you and your family. And so when I got out in the Marine Corps and went to an infantry officer course after graduation, Spent 6 months in Quantico at the basic school, which is every Marine goes to that. And then after that, 3 months in the infantry officer course, I got orders down to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And so I did the classic thing that every second lieutenant does, right? Just bought a house sight unseen and moved all my buddies into it. And so it was the classic military house hack, bought a 5-bedroom house and rented out all the rooms to buddies I just graduated IOC with. And so that was kind of my first taste into real estate. Learned a lot from that first transaction, right? Like, you never really know what you're doing until you actually put some money behind something. And so the power of the VA loan, right? Got a zero down loan and didn't have to pay a dime on that mortgage the whole time I owned the property. And so that was a really good learning experience. And that was kind of the first 2 years of me being in the Marine Corps, was figuring that part out and just owning a house myself and managing leases, living on site and doing that kind of a thing. And fast forward to like year three, and I met my wife. And are you married, Anthony? I think you are.
I am, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like, your wife probably wouldn't want to live in a frat house with four other lieutenants, right? And so for some reason, she wanted to move out and get a new place when we got married. And so that's what we did. And Hurricane Florence actually came through and wrecked some neighborhoods in our area right around that time, maybe like 6 months prior to us getting engaged. And so we found a foreclosure that had no roof, all that kind of stuff. It was real beat up, and we bought it. And actually I closed on that property on mainland Japan. So I was actually deployed when I closed [S2] Wow. [S1] On that one. So I'm sure you're familiar with buying stuff overseas, but [S2] Mm-hmm. [S1] I never thought you could do it. But if you play good enough sign language with the FedEx guy, they'll overnight your package in North Carolina. So that's what we did there, and bought a single family residential. And I did all the sweat equity on it, right? So I was working in there, laid all the floors, painted, did some drywall, did bathroom remodel, plumbing, electrical, pretty much all the major things other than a roof, HVAC, all that kind of stuff. Did hands-on and really kind of learned the process for renovating houses like that. And went off without a hitch, right? Moved right in, and we were in Camp Lejeune for about 8 or 9 months inside that house. And then got orders out to Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. And so me and my wife got married in October 2019. And so from there, we spent about that 9 months in the house and then moved across the country. And something about me is I'm a Christian guy, right? And so in Christianity, there's this thing called a tithe. And what that is basically you're supposed to give 10% of your income to a worthy cause, whether it's the church or charity or something like that. And so my wife and I were still feeling each other out, trying to figure out like what our family value is going to be, like what kind of causes are we going to support with our money? The local church is an easy one for us. Like that's something that doesn't take a lot of brain power, but with real estate, that money kind of ebbs and flows, right? It's not something that happens on a monthly basis, typically, unless you're a real estate agent and you've got like steady income like that. It's usually in like larger lump sums. And so we made about 25 grand on that live-in flip. We had bought the house for like 120 and sold it for 184, probably over rehabbed it because we were living in it. And when we sold it, so we made about 25 grand and we were trying to figure out where we wanted to give that money when we got to California. And we had closed on our other house and in California, which we bought. And she suggested that we give to Unbound Now, which is my mother-in-law's anti-human trafficking organization. And so in my mind, I was like, is Mrs. Peters running this thing out of her garage on a laptop, or like, what is the extent of this thing? Like, I'm sure she's doing some great work, right? I love her to death and cool organization, great thought. Don't know anything about human trafficking other than the annual trainings they make us take, right? And so I was like, sure, babe, like that sounds fine. $2,500 to support an anti-human trafficking organization that your mom runs, like, sounds great. Like, I'm sure they'll be appreciative, but in my mind, I'm like $2,500 is not that much money. Like that's not going to really do much, but glad to do it. And so we did. And my mother-in-law called us back and said, Tyler and Lindsay, like, thank you guys so much. Just so you understand, the amount of money you guys gave us, that's enough for half of a salary for somebody overseas that works full time on the border between Mongolia and China and is just snatching people out of slavery every day. And so I was like, holy cow, like, especially being in the military, right? And with you being near China, I'm sure you guys talk about China all the time. And even podcasts that have come out recently, if you listen to any Jordan Peterson or any of those other kinds of high profile podcasts, Joe Rogan, they're interviewing folks that have escaped from North Korea, got trafficked into China via human trafficking and stuff like that. And so when she said that and kind of put a number to it, for me, I'm like a very big numbers math guy. And so she said that, and I was like, man, we just flipped one house for just like giggles, right? It wasn't something that we were really trying to make a ton of money doing. We wanted to just enjoy it, and I knew it would make us some money, but I wasn't trying to get rich off of it. And I was like, man, if we flip one house without really trying, and we were able to fund half a year's worker's salary, what if we just did two this year and we could fund a whole worker? And then my mind's like, well, if you're going to do two, you might as well do three. So, well, if you're going to do three, you might as well do four. It's like the give a mouse a cookie principle, right? Where you just, once you've built those systems, like, why would you not continue to push? And so that's what we really decided to do. We decided to go all in on it and launch a legitimate business that's flipping homes inside of Waco, Texas. That's really what one branch of the business is doing. And then the other branch is looking at larger commercial deals to acquire and help run and raise money for and all that kind of stuff. But the ultimate goal for the business is to be able to give away $1 million a year in earned income to fight trafficking, and then $100,000 in passive. And so we're working on it right now. We're getting after it and making offers every day and running across deals and financing stuff. And it's been fun. We're actually closing on one today via mobile notary down in San Diego. So we're excited.
Awesome, man. That's amazing. I mean, your whole story is truly amazing. The path that you've taken. And I want to unpack a lot of that, cause there's a lot in there. When you're telling your mom about the one thing you weren't going to do was go to the Marine Corps and go infantry, that's funny because that's something similar I told my mom too. When I was a plebe, I told her the one thing I didn't want to do was be a submariner, because I couldn't deal with being underway and being underwater for that long and stuff. And here I am, 3 years later, I service selected it. So I feel your mom's pain that you ended up going down the path that you told her you wouldn't. Let's get into that first house that you bought, because I did something similar. I bought, a quad and moved in there and house hacked with my wife before we came out here. And used the VA loan as well. And it's an extremely useful and I guess unique tactic that we have as military, investors to be able to use this loan that's 0% down and be able to house hack something and live for free, essentially, and pocket all of your BAH and maybe even some more if you're able to cash flow off the property. So let's talk about that first property. How did you actually go about evaluating that property and knowing that, house hacking was a thing? Is, living with roommates is kind of going to school, after you graduate and going to a bunch of different military schools all over the place with the same people, you tend to, room up with people and go about that way. But house hacking especially with that many people, it's a little bit different. And especially when you own the property yourself versus just, renting a house with five other dudes that you're all kind of putting, pitching rent towards. So how did you go about actually finding and evaluating that house and knowing that it was going to be a good house for a house hack rather than just finding a one bedroom place that it was big enough for you and your eventual wife?
Yeah. So I was very much, just looking at it from a real basic numbers perspective. Right. So I was seeing how much stuff was renting for down there and going, man, like, I'm pretty sure a mortgage is way less than that. Like, why would I rent if I could just buy something? I'm going to be there for about 3 years. And then, obviously I had buddies that I was going through that course with and other buddies that were going to get orders down to Camp Lejeune. And I was like, man, I mean, why don't we all just pitch in and live in the same place? We probably would do that anyways. Why pay a landlord when I could be the one getting paid and I could probably buy a nicer place than what we would live in if we were just renting something. And so that was kind of my thought process. And I'm like an Excel nerd and like a that kind of a guy. And so made a really simple spreadsheet of just like analyzing, like, how much is a mortgage payment? How much is your insurance? How much taxes? How much should you like roughly set aside? And this is before Bigger Pockets and any sort of podcast like that for me. And just looked at it from that perspective and realized, I was like, man, I could give my buddies a really good deal And then I don't have to pay anything to live here. Like, this is, it would be free. And so I charged them like $425 a room, and there was four bedrooms in there, and mortgage was, I want to say, like $1,600, something like that. So I was like, pretty much just calculated it to where I would break even with me living in the house. Mm-hmm. And that's how I did it. And so I got a realtor through I played football at Navy as well. And so I basically contacted our alumni network and said, hey, do we got anybody down in Camp Lejeune that would, is a realtor that knows how to buy a property that's like a cash flowing property, right? And so got hooked up with my buddy, Brian Griffin. He's beast, love that guy. We did some good transactions with him. I preferred a lot of folks over his way, but just got hooked up with somebody I could kind of trust through osmosis, right? Like building those relationships with people like that. And yeah, he did a good old FaceTime tour, which I'm sure a lot of military folks are familiar with, buying a house on FaceTime, right? Mm-hmm. And the numbers checked out, and I was like, you know what, let's do it. And so I just kind of jumped into the deep end as fast as I could.
Love it. I love it, man. So, so what were you looking for in that house originally, knowing that you were going to house hack and knowing that, you know, it was going to be an investment property versus, you know, a house that was, you know, your primary residence that you're just going to be living in. And I asked that question because it's something that I think a lot of people don't necessarily think about when they go to buy a house initially.
Yep.
Is what is your overall end state? Like, what's your exit strategy going to be? Particularly if you're in the military and you know that you will be moving in, you know, 2, 3, 4 years from now. So what was the calculus going on in your head about, okay, you know, this house is worth this much. I can get this much in rent, this is how much my mortgage is. And did you think about the fact of what could be your exit strategy on the back end?
Yeah. So my main exit strategy was going to rent that thing forever. So I was planning on just holding on to it. And it was built in like 2010. So it was a newer build. So I wasn't as worried about what I now know is called CapEx and all those types of things, right? I was just thinking, hey, a pretty brand new house. It's like nothing's going to explode on me once I really move in there. And so I didn't think as much about appreciation as I kind of do now. So I could kind of compare that to the deal I'm in now, the one that I'm in California, which it's a high price market. And there's a lot of military folks that live in high price markets, right? Mm-hmm. And people want to buy a house in those kind of market, but I think what we've done is the way you should do it, in that we bought something that we walked right into equity with. So in North Carolina, $260,000 house, like it's not going to kill you if it falls apart. California, $550,000 house, it might hurt a little bit if you really get underwater on it. Like the percentage differences of being wrong there are a little different. Mm-hmm. And so what we bought, we pretty much walked into, we bought it for 540, and there's a house down the street that's under contract for around 745, exact same floor plan, new construction. And so what our purpose there was, we had multiple exit strategies now. Like previously, my North Carolina house was more you can hold on to it long-term, it's not going to hurt you, but it's not going to probably appreciate very much. In California, we could probably rent the house I'm in right now for $3,800 or $4,000, and our mortgage is $2,700. And so there's a lot more delta there. CapEx is taken care of, but then also we have the appreciation built in because of the way we bought it and the price we bought in at. Mm-hmm. In order to, if we did want to sell it, we'd be able to get out from underneath it and make some good money on it. And so that's the main things I think military folk need to think about is, could you rent it out and hold on to it? Will it bleed you to death if you do? If that's the worst case scenario, is that you're breaking even, then maybe consider it, right? Really run the numbers and see what your goals are. But the dream scenario, I think, is what we've got going right now is you've got appreciation and you've got cash flow. Either direction that you want to go, you can take the appreciation and sell, or you could hold on to it and let it cash flow and pay down the mortgage and get all the tax benefits of a rental property as well.
Absolutely. That's a sort of thing I want to pinpoint there, because I think when people go and buy a house, they don't necessarily think about what type of market they're initially in. And I want to get into that, because I think you do a lot about analyzing markets and,
yep,
and looking at the data behind it. But when buying a house or buying a property, or really buying real estate in general, understanding the fact that there's two main markets, and there's a cash flow market and there's an appreciation market. and you ultimately win using different strategies within those markets. And just due to the nature of the market, most of the time you're not going to find an appreciation market that's a cash flow, that's also a cash flow market, and vice versa. It's just how the market is. So for example, like in California, you're seeing a lot more of a of appreciation markets just due to prices just being insane, right? But you're at the same time, you're finding houses a lot more expensive. There's a lot less delta, or I guess potentially a lot less delta to be able to cash flow off of for that amount of money. Something similar in Atlanta, but in the Midwest, for example, you're able to find much more tenable properties that are able to be cash flowed just because due to the fact that they're stable, they're, you know, the property value is pretty much going to stay the same. Unless you're forced appreciating it, and you're able to have a stable cash flow coming in off of those properties. So I think that's something subtle to understand is what do you ultimately want from your property, right? If it's to go down the path of flipping, or it's to go down the path of profiting from appreciation, that's a different play than going for a cash flowing market, right? Especially if you're planning on holding it for, you know, 5, 10, 15, you know, the rest of your life. And that's something that I think a lot of people don't necessarily think about when you're going into that is that calculus and how it goes into it, particularly if you're raising money for these deals, right? When you're trying to, when you're trying to, you know, present a deal that's cash flowing, that's going to be giving off, you know, 8-10% in an appreciation market. Well, a lot of that profit's probably going to be on the back end when you go to refinance or sell the property. And that's good to know for an investor versus if it's going to be cash flowing from day one. And most of the profits you're going to be getting are from the actual cash flow vice the acquisition or the appreciation on the back end. So, sorry, what were you going to say?
And another thing that's important too is when you're buying in high price markets, you really need to understand what the tax benefits are. And so this property is a really good example that we have. We bought it for 540, right? And we, I mean, interest rates are so low. This, like, somebody watching this in a year, who knows what the rates are going to be, right? But we're in for 2.25. And so when you look at the amortization schedule on a 2.25, 30-year fixed loan, you're paying $1,000 into interest and the rest of it's going to principal every month. And so take that $1,000 of interest, multiply that by 12, there's $12,000 of tax benefits, right? All of your taxes up to 10 grand, you can write off as a tax benefit. And then when you move out of that property, you can then start depreciating it as a rental. And that depreciation on 530,000 is a heck of a lot more than the depreciation on, say, $150,000 rental property that, sure, maybe it cash flows $200, but the tax benefits are not even close to the same. And so that's something to consider. Because I know there's a lot of folks that live in San Diego, live in those big expensive markets, and they're like, I can't find anything that hits my minimum $200 a month of cash flow and all those types of things. But if you kind of turn the equation around and really look at what's going to save you money, like saving you $200 of taxes a month is the equivalent of $200 of cash flow. You just have to understand the risks of what you're potentially taking on and stuff like that. But understanding taxes in high price markets, I think, is one of the biggest skills you could have if you're going to be house hacking, you're going to be doing stuff like that, because it changes the math for you. And it allows you to actually buy stuff that makes sense where other people might pass up on it. Like, and I think our house is a perfect example of that. Majority of people would pass on it because it's such a high price market, but understanding the tax benefits is really one of those things that kind of pushes us over the edge to make sure we close on it.
Absolutely. Like, I couldn't agree more. So for the learners that may not know what depreciation is, because it's not a tax strategy that you would really understand or really be exposed to if you didn't have an investment property, right? Or you didn't own a property outside of your primary home. So explain what depreciation is and how, what that actually means and how it makes a difference when you're making your calculus.
Yeah. So what depreciation is it's, you take the value of the home when you purchased it. And for residential, it's like 27 and a half years, I believe is the right number. And you divide it by 27 and a half years. And every year you're able to write that number off on your regular taxes. And so that's true. It's money saving in your pocket. So if you're able to write off $1,000 of depreciation, that's $1,000 of taxable income that's no longer taxed at your highest tax bracket. So for folks that are in a high tax environment, right? Say you're getting 40% capital gains, you're a accredited investor. and you've got $1,000 of appreciation, you're saving $400 on that $1,000 because it's being written off as depreciation. And it's all paper losses, which means it's not a type of thing where you're actually giving up $1,000 to the government. They're saying that your property, because of wear and tear and stuff like that, is losing $1,000 in paper value, and they're going to allow you to account for that on your tax return. And so it's just, you can see where the numbers are go for that. So if you're in the 25% tax bracket, you go ahead and you save $250 on each $1,000 you're able to write off. And a perfect example of that is Donald Trump, right? Like, you see people get super worked up about him paying no income tax. It's like, guys, it's because the dude's got infinity depreciation. He's writing all his earned income off on.
Yeah.
And like my rental property, the one that I moved out of, the 5-bedroom one, I think we cleared around like 36,000 or something like that. Don't quote me on that number. Do math in public, right?
Yeah.
But they gave me back $12 of tax money. I think I owed $12 on that total thing because of all the different ways you can write off income. And we were cash flowing $500 a month on that property after expenses. And so it's one of those things where if you know the rules and you know how to navigate within those worlds, it ain't rocket science. It's not, you ain't going to nuke school. You ain't going to nuke power school to figure this out. It's if an infantry guy like me can figure it out, then pretty much anybody can figure it out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's the power of investing in real estate in general, is it's a huge tax benefit and a huge tax play, whether you're actively investing in real estate or passively investing, and even more so if you're passively investing, because now you're getting cash flow essentially for free, right? If you're depreciating a large property, you know, successfully over time. And another thing to think about there is what's called a cost segregation analysis, where you can upfront load all of that depreciation, most of it, you know, within the first 5-10 years. So instead of having to hold a property for 27 years, you can get, you know, 50, 60, 70%, depending on how the study's done, within the first 5 years of you holding that property. So for those investors out there who are going out and raising capital for these larger deals, think about that fact, is that, you know, you're getting, you would say for a $5 million property, you could potentially get $1.5 million back within the first 5 years of depreciable taxes back. And the value could be going up the whole time. And that's something that is huge. And when you're offsetting your cash flow. So like you said, you could be, you cash flow $500 a month, but you actually got a tax return that showed that you got money back on that, even though you had all these extra expenses, you had all this actual income coming in off of that property. It didn't matter. And that's something similar I found with all of my properties as well. And even more so when you get into larger commercial properties or you know, multifamily buildings, it's all the same.
Something for people to understand though, is you will get that money taxed eventually. So it ain't free. Like they will do, it's called depreciation recapture, and Uncle Sam's going to get his, but you can delay that as long as you can using some other different strategies. And I feel obligated to say this. Our lawyers will probably like really want me to comment on the fact that I am not a CPA. This is not tax advice. And it's kind of like in the infantry, right? I'm not a JTAC. Like I can't, like if this bomb falls on you, it's on you, but that's what we do inside of our business. And we consult with our CPA for all that kind of advice. And they're the ones who do my taxes. I don't touch my taxes when it comes to that kind of stuff for legality reasons and all that stuff. But yeah, we are not CPAs. Do not take this as tax advice and do not sue us.
Absolutely. No, in all of these situations, whether you're investing in real estate or stocks or capital market in general, you should definitely reach out to a CPA to figure out your particular tax situation, because some of these things may not apply. You may not have, you may make too much income for this even to be applicable to you. So definitely, I think the point is understand what is available to you, particularly with just owning real estate in general, and how that could affect you and how that could affect your taxes, because it's crazy. I mean, it's so funny when people talk about it, get all upset about Donald Trump and you know these other billionaires who are paying nothing in taxes. It's like, well, yeah, they know how to play the game. You know, ultimately. Someone once told me that's our responsibility as Americans to pay as little taxes as possible. And if you're just using the existing tax code, even more, you know, even better for you. Right. Yeah. But
that's a good Bible verse there is render to Caesar what is Caesar's, right? Mm-hmm. So that's like, I'm all about it. Like I tell my CPAs, like, hey, I want to pay negative if you can get me negative. I don't want to break any laws, but like get me to that point where we're claiming every single thing we can, because in our minds at the end of the day, like kind of what I was talking about earlier, like we don't have revenue goals inside of our business. We've got a generosity goal. And so every dollar I give to the government is dollars that I'm not directing to help fight trafficking and help fight other causes that we're passionate about. Right. And so people, I think, have a misconception that like using these kinds of tax strategies are like shady or they're like deceitful or something like that. It's like, well, I would pose a different question. I would say, who do you think is going to do a better job of stewarding your money, the federal government or you? It's like, if you think it's going to be you, then do some tax strategies. You think the federal government's going to be able to optimize and use the money the most efficiently way and do that kind of a thing, then sure, go pay more taxes and give it to them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's my soapbox. I'll get off it now. But
yeah, no, I mean, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I think particularly guys in the military, the only you know, time that you ever deal with taxes is when you take your W-2 off of, you know, a MyPay and give it to your CPA, or you go on to, you know, you go on to Intuit and do your taxes to like TurboTax. And then you see how much you get in return. And just think about the fact that that's how much, you know, you're getting in tax returns off of just your current job. Now think about all the extra benefits you could get from taxes with owning real estate or investing in real estate in general. And it's just, it's huge. It's a huge benefit. But again, yes, please reach out to your CPA, because that's and really your attorneys as well, because that's information that they're going to know it's applicable to you as well. So let's get into the flipping side of things in Waco. You know, there's a lot of markets out there, obviously, that are, you know, cash flowing markets, depreciation markets. There's markets who are doing extremely well in terms of population growth and job growth, and some that are not doing so well. And you, particularly within multifamily and commercial real estate, you tend to see people gravitate towards, you know, a few different markets because they're the flavor of the week, and that's where they're seeing the most bang for their buck, and so on and so forth. But you guys are focusing on a different market than what a lot of other people are focusing on in Waco. So, you know, what are you doing when you're analyzing this data in terms of actual analysis of markets to figure out, yes, Waco is a good market and, you know, Dallas is not, or, you know, Lubbock, Texas is a good market and, you know, Corpus Christi is not? What's going into that? Because I think that's a really great conversation to have, because I think it's kind of subjective, but kind of not in the same time.
Yeah. So what we do is I've written some code. I'm using Python as a programming language, and I take data down off of Realtor.com, Zillow.com, Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Census, all those different kind of open source areas, rip it down from the internet in real time, and then synthesize it into actionable information. Right. And so what my belief is that most markets have somewhere that's a good place to invest. And what we're able to do is get down from the national to the state, to the county, to the zip code, to the neighborhood level with really a couple clicks of the mouse and a couple key commands I type into my code and really evaluate markets down to that level of granularity. And so we know a deal when it comes up. We know when, if I'm looking at a property and it's 275,000 and it pops up on the MLS, but it's in this zip code, in this neighborhood, and within 5 minutes, I'm able to basically get myself up to speed if that's an area we're targeting after doing some of this research and figuring out what the kind of the baselines are for that area. Mm-hmm. And go, man, this one's a 3-2, 1600 square feet listed for 275. I know that the median price point in this area is 400. Like, this is a deal as long as there's not X, Y, or Z wrong with it. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, we send our boots on the ground and be like, hey, this one just popped up. And the boots on the ground, if it's on the MLS, is our real estate agent. And then if it's a wholesale deal, it's our equity partners on the ground down in Waco. And so we really are dialed into that kind of information. And so we know when something pops up, if it's like, okay, this is an outlier, this is something that shouldn't be here. Is it here because either they don't know how to price it or it's distressed enough to where we can acquire it quickly? And so that's the like acquisition side of the house. And then really my role inside the business is I source all of the financing. So we work with a lot of private lenders. And so we're capable of closing in cash. in as little as really like 3 days or so, depending on the quality of the deal. And that's how we kind of go about business. So we see something pops up, we move faster than everybody else, and our numbers are backed up by hard data, which I think is something that the private lenders tend to like, the fact that we actually have a good finger on the pulse and we're not kind of just doing one of these and like sticking our finger in the wind and going, I think the market's not going to turn. It's like, no, we really watch the market very, very closely, and close enough to where before we make those decisions, right, we see, okay, right now the housing market is hot and people are like, man, it's really starting to like cool down, more inventories on the market. It's like, yeah, more inventories on the market, but we went from 20 houses to 40 houses listed, and usual healthy market's still 100. So we're able to like more confidently, I think, move because of that data analysis. And so for us, we picked Waco because we think it's strategically located between those two huge, really three huge MSAs of Austin, San Antonio, and Dallas. And we've got some other insights into that community that we really believe in that market. And so that's where we're planting our flag. And then I think, like, personally, I think it's a God thing that we're in that market. And it's a good market because that's where Unbound was founded as well. And so we've got really good community ties inside of there to where we've got tons of folks that are pulling for us to succeed, and a lot of mentors that are like, you know what, like we'll help Tyler out. And that's really what helped us kind of get the grease going and skids kind of greased for us to break into a market from a distance. Cause it's very difficult to do real estate investing from a distance if you don't have folks on the ground that are willing to support you.
Yeah. So there's two things out of that I want to unpack, cause it's extremely important what you just said. The first thing is it's the value of knowing like granularity on the local market, right? Exactly what you're saying, you know, zip codes, you know, down to the neighborhood, you know, enough to like, hey, this is a war zone and the street over is, you know, up and coming or path of progress, right? I think a lot of people, particularly when they're looking at larger markets like Dallas or Atlanta or even in California, just look at the whole market and think that all of Atlanta is the same or all of Dallas is the same. And when you get down deeper into it, you look at the fact that those MSAs are made up of much smaller individual neighborhoods and much smaller population groups and much smaller bases where companies are headquartered, or a lot of people are this type of industry, right? And so that's awesome that you're able to get extremely granular and be extremely local on your knowledge base, because ultimately that's the power of real estate. Is real estate is hyper local, right? And it's hard to broad brushstroke real estate numbers and be like, oh yes, this works generally across the whole United States, because it could be extremely different in Waco versus Dallas. And that's, you know, maybe a couple hours away.
And we used our code we used it to buy a flip in Florida. So we weren't involved in it. Completely different market, completely different area. But just because of the way we're pulling the data down, same amount of time to analyze that niche market and confirm it. It was my dad's flip that he was doing, but that's the power of being able to use big data like that, is you can really open up a new market for us. That's kind of what our thesis is. Right now we're very much in like the startup mode and trying to build our capital base so that flipping now is just turns into our own kind of well-oiled machine. But when you're doing what we're doing, you're really able to open up new markets as long as you've got folks on the ground that can take care of business for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, and I think to your point, you talk about how you use this big data to really get an edge on the rest of the competition and figure out the market. But I think the reason that you're able to do that so well, obviously you're really good at doing the acquisition side of thing, but also the fact that you're focusing on one particular market. Yep. You know, I think when you have three or four or five, or, you know, the whole country that you're going after, sure, you get a lot more deals coming down the pipeline, but you're also having to go and spend a lot more time trying to figure out, okay, this property is in Louisiana. I've never looked at a property in Louisiana, or I've never looked at a property in Arizona. And so ultimately you have to do a lot more time, you know, time intensive management and understanding of that market, versus just focusing on one city and being hyper local on that and knowing that, hey, this property just came on the MLS, or it's in this neighborhood. You know, somebody brought it to me through a wholesaler. I know exactly, like, within, you know, 5-10 minutes, this is a property that I want or don't want. And it's a lot harder to do that when you have, you know, multiple different markets, especially as a startup, especially as a new guy. You know, I see a lot of people gravitating towards all these markets and talking with all of these brokers when you could get extremely local to a particular market and still find good deals, and probably even more so, because now you have established relationships there with the team members that you'll actually need, like property managers, lenders, brokers within that area, rather than trying to be in 10 different places all at once. So I think that that's a really important lesson to understand, particularly when you're getting started, is one, being as local as possible and knowing the market like the back of your hand, and two, focusing on one or two markets and really having to being the experts within those markets. I can't emphasize that enough, how important that is, not only to make sure you're getting the right deals and you know how to evaluate those deals pretty quickly, but also for investors as well. If you are a new investor and you're trying to bring on passive investors to your cause, and you're saying, hey, we're in 10 different markets. Well, you know, your investors may not want to be in 10 different markets. They may only want to be in two of those markets, right? So needless to say, I think it's just, you need to be more intentional about the markets. One, the markets that you're in, and be an expert within that market. And it sounds like that's exactly what you guys are doing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that are very afraid of missing out. They got a lot of FOMO when it comes to, man, I've heard Dallas is hot. I've heard Tampa's hot. I've heard Fort Lauderdale's hot. And by spreading yourself that thin, you've got to be able to move fast. Like, you've got to be faster than the other people that are bidding on these properties. And if you can't be fast, you better bring a ton of cash and be willing to overpay. And so that's where I'm a proponent of building the system completely and getting it ready, like push button, like turnkey, basically real estate investing. And once you're at that level and it's like subconscious, then start considering opening another market, at least in the single family world. The single family world is very much, because there's a lot more transactions that you're doing. You really, I think, should stay focused on one market. With multifamily, I would be a little contrarian there. And I would say, really, you're building a team in those markets. And if you're able to acquire the deals or find the deals and underwrite a market in a larger way, I think there are multifamily folks that are able to do multiple markets, but probably not 10. Maybe you're looking at 3, maybe you're looking at 2. And so it's like not the shotgun effect. It's still pretty directed, but yeah, I think there's slight nuances there.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know, every type of real estate is going to be different how you go about looking at them or evaluating them, right? You're going to be looking for different aspects. You're going to be looking at different indications for a market that are going to make it a good market or a bad market for your particular type of real estate. So absolutely agree. You know, there's not a silver bullet when it comes to investing in real estate. Everyone has their own way of doing things, and everyone makes money in their own particular way. So totally agree there. But hey, Tyler, we're getting towards the end of the episode. You ready to get into the snapshot round?
Yeah, let it rip.
All ahead, plank, cavitate, snapshot, tube.
All right, here we go. First question for you. Tyler, what is your number one failure in real estate?
Man, I over rehabbed that 5-bedroom place. So I was so dumb. I put 2 full bathrooms into it. And so it turned into a 5-bedroom, 5.5-bath monster. And so everybody had their own bath. Everyone had their own full bath. And I was like, this is awesome. All my friends don't have to watch each other shower. It's great. But when it came to resale, right, who on earth wants to buy a 5-bedroom, 5.5-bath house? There's not a lot of people that want to buy that. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that was my biggest failure. We didn't lose money. We made money on the cash flow side. But when we came to like selling it on the appreciation side, we pretty much broke even. You know, I think my escrow check refund was bigger than the profits from the actual sale of the house. And so, I would say that was probably my biggest failure to date, is just over rehabbing it and leading with emotions and not with your brain.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I think that's something you just gain from experience and just doing it over and over and over again. Yep. Absolutely. As an active duty investor, what advice do you have for other military investors to be successful?
Yeah. Don't suck at your job. Be a good officer, be a good Marine, be a good enlisted folk. Like, don't suck at your job, because it does carry over. And there's plenty of guys I know that are real estate investors, and the ones that are really successful are probably also very, very good at their actual day job. And so I think there's a hype culture that we've kind of encountered. And I think there's like a weird military real estate investing niche where folks are just using the military to just pay for their real estate investing gig. And I think maybe they'll be a little successful, but I think long-term you're not developing the right kind of character and the right kind of mindset to be successful long-term. Mm-hmm. And so I would say, don't suck at your job, please. Like, we're in the military to serve our country. And then real estate, you can do a phenomenal job. You can be excellent while being active duty. And that's what we're striving to be. Right. Mm-hmm. But, you still need to have your priorities in the right place. So fellow military investors, I'll get off my soapbox, but that's just something that grinds me sometimes. I see people, I'm like, man, do you ever work? Like, what's going on here? Like, you need to, like, you've got people that depend on you. So I don't know.
Yeah. All good. Preaching. All right. What inspired you to serve your country?
Man, I wanted to play football in college real bad. Like, that was my dream. And so that's how it started out. Mm-hmm. But really what got me through to graduation from Naval Academy and actually serving is wanting to be a part of a team, right? Wanting to be in the locker room for as long as I could. And so that's one of the biggest reasons I chose the infantry. Is I felt like that was going to be the biggest locker room experience I could get. And I think it was true. So really I wanted to serve with other folks that were passionate and that were motivated. And I've gotten to do that so far. It's been good. So it's really the people. That's really what led me to service, I think.
Perfect. And the last question for you, and you've kind of hit on this a lot, but what is your dream?
Man, the dream is to build a business that gives away, like, our biggest problem is giving away money. So we're trying to figure out who needs it the most. And so that would be my dream, is figuring out a way to build something so big that we can be more generous than I think we even dreamed. Hopefully $1 million a year and 100,000 in passive is kind of just like the first benchmark, and we can kind of scale beyond that.
Love it. Tyler, I really appreciate you coming on here and sharing your knowledge. If people want to learn more about you, where can they go?
Yeah, you can shoot me an email at tyler@ltginvestments.com. I'll respond to those. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. We've got an Instagram page, ltginvestments.com. And then our website, again, shocker, is ltginvestments.com. And so, yeah, that's how you can get a hold of me. And happy to talk shop with anybody, or if there's ever anything I can do for anybody, just reach out and we'll see if we can help.
Awesome. Thanks, Tyler, and have a great day.
Yeah, thanks, brother.
Thanks for listening. If you are a military investor and found this episode of the Lessons in Real Estate show packed with great information, tell your friends and leave a 5-star rating on your listening platform. Every comment is read and appreciated. Don't forget to check out our weekly episodes of PCI Teaches, brought to you by Pinto Capital Investments. Learn about basic and advanced topics in real estate investing. Catch updates on Anthony's journey through Learn and Teach segments. And listen to the tales of other military investors and real estate professionals every week. We'll catch you next time on the Lessons in Real Estate show.